How often do you see a tree and really see a tree? Now, I'm not talking about a structure of bark and leaves that emerges randomly from the ground. I'm talking about living, breathing organisms with a personality of their own. Trees are something that provide us with so much more than just shade in the summer and fruit in the autumn. They give us the oxygen that we breathe, they provide habitats for wildlife, they stabilize the mycelium in the soil. And no two are ever the same. Each tree that you encounter has its own history, its own magnificence, its own wisdom, and its own stories to tell. Do you ever look at an oak tree with a trunk as thick as a small car and wonder what it has seen in its lifetime? How many generations have gone before it? How many seasons have passed before its eyes? What would it teach you if it had the chance? Have you ever looked at a mangrove forest and seen the way that trees, despite all adversity, they twist and they turn in countless directions just to find a little peak of sunlight emerging from the canopy floor? What would they teach you about resilience? What can they teach you about never giving up? Have you ever stared wide-eyed at an entire forest and noticed how each tree stands in all of its glory and all of its magnificence without ever once comparing or competing with others? And have you ever stopped to say thank you? For without trees, none of us would be here. So the truth is, I've been fascinated by trees for as long as I can remember. As a child, if I wasn't climbing a conifer or picking fruit from an apple tree, I'd be having full-on conversations with them when no one was watching. Seriously, and I still do. Growing up, I realized just how important trees are, not just for the planet, but for the people that we walk it with. As managed correctly, tree planting can also provide jobs and habitats and even education, which we're going to come onto later. Which is why last year, Vivo Life made a pledge to plant one tree for every order on our website. And thanks to our community, we are now a matter of days away from planting our 200,000th tree. When we plant trees, we do so with the help of a charity called Eden Projects, who take a holistic approach to tree planting worldwide. They only plant native and indigenous trees to their local environment, and they give back to local communities by providing careers and education. Today on the podcast, I'm joined by the founder and CEO of Eden Projects, Steve Fitch, to give an insight into how those trees are planted, where they are planted, and who plants them. I wanted to shine a light on just how important this is, and you will see that the simple act of tree planting can provide a sustainable solution, not just for our environment, but for the crisis of poverty, which is just as big and probably less talked about. The reason that people are logging trees and depleting our resources is because they have no choice. They have to do it to feed their family. So by creating sustainably managed tree planting projects, reforestation projects like Eden Projects do, we not only tackle the environmental crisis, but we tackle the human crisis of poverty too. Now, in this podcast, there are a couple of audio hiccups. Steve joined me all the way from LA, and he's an incredibly busy man, so I was so, so grateful to have some of his time. But please bear with it, and you will see what an amazing organization Eden Projects are, and you'll see why we're so proud to be working with them. And you'll also see what we can do to help. You know, the power is not just with companies and corporations. The power is in all of our hands. So thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. I hope that you will get something out of this podcast, and yeah, grateful as always. This was a lot of fun. So I will see you on the other side. And we're good to go. So I'm here with Steve Fitch, the founder of Eden Projects. Now, for those that aren't fully aware, Eden Projects are the company that we partner with to plant trees all around the world. They are an incredible organization, and they are the vehicle for us to make a very, very small change in the world by planting one tree for every order that our customers and our community produce. So Steve, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Great to be here, Josh. And honestly, thank you for your partnership. You make a bigger difference than you give yourself credit for.
Thank you. It means a lot. But I would love to hear from your perspective, the story of Eden Projects. You know, how did it start, and from where did it start? You know, was this a personal passion of yours, or is it something that was stumbled across?
Both. I've always been a nature nut, and you know, my parents were missionaries, so I grew up in a tropical paradise in the southern Philippines. So jungle and tribal groups and coral reefs, and I mean, it was a Tarzan type experience growing up. So in college, I started off as a biology major and got directed away from that eventually, but I think it was organic chemistry knocked me out. So bottom line is, years later, I was working part-time in Ethiopia doing kind of traditional development work, you know, building hospitals and medical clinics, working with the HIV plague that had hit Africa, and building schools, all the good traditional development stuff. But I also became friends with Haile Mariam of the Southern People's Region. He was the president of the Southern People's Region, later became the prime minister. And one day, kind of out of the blue, he asked me, well, he complimented me first, which, you know, you're in trouble when a politician complimented you, right? He said, you really get a lot done. And then he said, you're ignoring our nation's greatest need. And he talked about the environmental destruction, which I had seen from my boyhood home in the Philippines being wiped out, to watching literally national parks in Ethiopia disappearing, being cut down tree by tree. And bottom line is, he asked me if I'd be willing to take over a failed EU-funded and led forest restoration project. And, you know, that is definitely a what the hell kind of a question is that, you know. And but the way I was raised, I have I guess you say a proclivity or an orientation to know how to relate well to people living in village cultures. So I found myself out at Uduwatete sitting down with the village elders and just processing with them what happened. Why did the project fail? And I also was entering a dissertation phase for my doctorate. And I went back to my committee and said, hey, I want to study what works and what doesn't when it comes to forest restoration. It was easy to find out what doesn't, because this EU-funded project was classic. But bottom line is it started out of a kind of a life passion to care about nature, but then an accidental meeting from my perspective that was based on a lifetime experience of knowing how to relate to people in village settings.
Mm.
And it resulted in a doctoral study that came to the conclusion, if you don't care for the local population and their socioeconomic needs, then your project, your forest restoration project, will fail.
Mm.
Because people are desperate. And if you've got kids or your listeners have kids, and you can cut down that tree and those two or three trees over there to turn those trees into charcoal so that you'll have enough money to buy food again for this week and next, you'd do it.
For sure.
And so the whole idea of employed to plant, you know, caring for their socioeconomic need, is get rid of their desperation where they have to cut down trees in order to survive, and give them a real job, give them a productive job to produce trees in nurseries and other systems, to plant trees and then to protect trees. And it's worked really well, and we're closing in on 400 million trees.
You
since that eventful day. So there you go.
Amazing. No, that is, so beautiful to hear. And the people side, I want to touch on that a bit more, because I think that is such a key part of what you do. I remember when we were looking for the right company for us to partner with to plant trees, there are many organizations doing similar things, but what struck me about Eden Projects was the human side, and how you aren't just investing in reforestation and ecological efforts, you're investing in people as well. Talk to me a little bit more about that process and how that would work, and how that can be different from, you know, from okay, let's use the example of the failed EU project. You know, what did you do differently compared to the failed one?
Yeah, well, you're going to be the first one I try this analogy out on.
Okay.
So you've got a mathematical equation with a numerator and a denominator. And every problem, in a sense, has a numerator and a denominator. What are you really trying to divide? What are you trying to fix and resolve? So the EU project thought the denominator was trees. And I said, no, in my studies, switch it. The denominator is people, because they're the ones cutting down the trees out of desperation. So if you'll care for this bottom part first, you'll get trees. But the EU project, they weren't paying them. In fact, they were, in a sense, using government programs to force them to work in the nurseries and to grow the trees and to plant the trees. And they complied. And then at night, they let their goats, their cattle, their sheep, their camels, everything else go out where they just planted and eat it. So they got something out of it. They got they fed their flock for the night, or for the day. But what we did is flip the equation. And this is the hard part for a lot of people to even get this. Eden is first about caring for people as a means to care for the planet.
For sure. Well, so it makes complete sense to me the way you describe it, because ultimately people are the reason we are in this mess. So it has to be people are the reason that we come out of it. And if we treat
well said.
If we treat trees like a commodity, you know, I chop one down over here and I plant one over here, it's the same equation that is causing us to enter into the brink of environmental destruction, because we're not looking at the holistic perspective. And this is why I think what you're doing is so profound.
What we're doing.
Okay. I must learn to rephrase that. Wow. Okay. And are you still working on that same project in Ethiopia now?
We're about to reemerge in Ethiopia. We wrapped up after, 10-ish years, the Uduwatete. And honestly, there was a lot of learning curve in Ethiopia, including dealing with very corrupt systems. Mm-hmm. And so since then, we fixed that, and we think we have managed, we have managed to avoid that same kind of problem. So we're going back into Ethiopia next year, but okay. We've expanded into Madagascar, into Nepal, Indonesia, Haiti, Mozambique. Excuse me. Hey, Claudette, I'm on a podcast. So sorry about that. My wife just got in.
No,
she's a doctor of physical therapy, works at a local clinic, and comes home for lunch. So she came in on the phone. So sorry about that.
No worries.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So Madagascar, Nepal, Ethiopia is coming back. What is it that makes you choose a project? You know, is it the people? Is it the way that it's been, that the environment has been treated there? Is it a mixture of all of the above?
Well, then, I mean, people say, how do you find spots to reforest in the world? And I my analogy there is, well, how do you find sand on a beach? that there's no shortage of environmental destruction. Like Haiti is probably 99% deforested.
Yep.
Nepal is 80%. Madagascar is 90%. Mozambique's 75 to 80, and the list goes on and on. All the nations where we work are decimated. So that's easy. The simple answer to how do we choose is you got to find reliable leadership networks. So you can build infrastructure to get into all of these nooks and crannies, villages that are up against these deforested areas. And then you have to develop all the infrastructure system. I mean, we have about 20,000 village employees now. Wow. So how do you pay 20,000 people spread across the planet? And they live in the middle of nowhere, and you got to pay them in cash or some kind of unique equivalent to cash. Like in Madagascar, where we work, you can give them cash, but there's nothing to buy in Mahabara or Kalamboro. So we have an arrangement that this is your salary. What do you want us to deliver to you every month? We want two bags of rice. We want a bed. They start listing all the things they want us to buy and deliver via boat. It's kind of crazy.
Wow.
But that's the complexities. Yeah.
Wonderful. Yeah. And okay, so and how do you navigate that? You know, how do you go into a situation where, you know, it's in the middle of nowhere, as you say, in the middle of the jungles of Madagascar? How do you go about building that relationship with the native and indigenous people and actually use this to become a harmonious relationship that benefits both them and also their environment?
Well, first of all, whatever you do, you do your best to find existing well-established relationships, good infrastructure, and you look for a bottom-up approach as opposed to a lot of organizations. They start with the government. Government people don't know anybody in a village in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So we find leaders that know the people in the middle of nowhere, and develop those relationships, and then we percolate up and get the legal agreements with the government. And to make it work, it's always important that you Malagasify it, you Haitify it, you Ethiopiafy it. So you don't come in telling them what we're going to do, other than the generalities. We're going to pay you to produce, plant, and protect forest. That takes some talking, because they don't really typically believe anybody's dumb enough to pay them to do that. But once you get past that and you really start to deliver, then you got to make sure it makes sense to them. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, this sounds maybe strange, but my guess is you don't want some damn American coming over to your section of the UK and telling you what to do, do you?
Maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, but we're really good at doing that. First world people, wealthy, affluent nation leaders think that they can tell these folks what to do, and that's why it frequently doesn't work.
You are absolutely right, and we also think we know what they would want in return as well, right? We think that, you know, for us, we live in a capitalist society, so it must be all about money and this must be a transaction. But I'm sure for many of the people at the projects you work at, you know, these are the last of their worries, you know. And as you said, with the example in Madagascar, they are after the simple things, a bed, food to eat, and they don't actually have currency to exchange. So the beautiful thing is to be able to build that relationship that is not transactional. It's actually holistic, and it benefits the people, it benefits the planet, and it allows them to work in a way that is natural to them as well. You know, the last thing that you want to do is to go in there and say, right, this is how, you know, this is how you plant trees, this is how you do it. It's their land, you know, they inhabit it, and they would most likely have so much more of a better perspective on how they can treat the problem too. So the key is right. Is listening.
And listening, I mean, for instance, we launched Central America starting last year, but really getting it going this year. And as I spent time at, you know, there are indigenous people in Central America that are true. They're not Spanish culture.
Mm-hmm.
So these remnant indigenous people, and they didn't want to be paid. It was the oddest thing from our perspective. They wanted us to build a schoolhouse and bring in an indigenous trained teacher.
Wow.
that would ensure their children spoke their native language.
Wow.
And they wanted to make sure that every single thing we did benefited the entire community, because they're a communal culture. So they wanted a water project. They wanted a better road. They didn't want individuals being paid. They wanted that big picture communal thing.
Mm.
And just working with the different cultures, you find out they have some pretty cool thought processes that aren't greedy bastard stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's fun.
Fantastic. It really is. Amazing. Yeah. Okay, so looking at the environment itself then, so how do you see, as the trees grow and mature, how do you see the environment in which you work start to change?
Well, yeah, good question. I mean, you know, first of all, there's fairly quickly in the process, when they're getting paid, their desperation goes away. Mm. They begin to develop a new identity. Instead of people who prey on the environment, they're people who become caretakers of their environment. They begin to own this place. And the trees in many cases grow very fast, because tropical systems can grow quickly. So typically, survival rates can be as low as 60%, as high as 80%. But what's amazing is usually after about years two, three, four, depending on the system, natural regeneration kicks in and becomes prolific. And so when people say, what's your survival rate, for instance, I would say, well, it's an irrelevant question because nature outproduces us. And so usually about year five to six, you're now starting to have a truly healthy ecosystem. And so the farming is improving. The flooding is stopping. Literally the water systems are starting to come back into order. Like the erosion stops, the landslides stop. And if we're doing mangroves, I don't remember, are you guys at a mangrove site or at a terrestrial site?
Well, we're actually worldwide, so we're looking after all your sites. Yeah.
So if you're in the mangrove systems, you know, which are those creek, those kind of crazy trees that grow in salt, shrimp and the fish start to come back, and so their fisheries improve. And I've watched, for instance, erosion because all the mangrove, huge mangrove forests have been cut down. Now the ocean's blue again because all the sediment's being trapped by a healthy mangrove system again. And it's so the transformation over time is remarkable. Nature is remarkable. It fixes a lot of stuff. Yeah, fun.
Definitely fun. And it must be so rewarding, not just for Eden Projects, in fact, in a very small part for Eden Projects, but for the people who are there to see that and to see the benefits that can happen when you work with nature and not against it. The key here as well is not, you know, we have to understand that the reason they are working against nature and deforestation and chopping down trees and decimating the landscape is because they are left with no other choice because of how it has been set up. So that, you know, if in order to survive, to put food on the table, they have to use the resources. The amazing thing is that there is a different way. And this is what we are showing by the approach that we're taking here. So it's really amazing. Mm-hmm. Cool. Okay. So what does success look like to you? How do you quantify if you've done a good job on a project or if you haven't? You know, if you're going into a new project, let's use a Central America for example, do you have targets of where you want to be in 3, 5, 10 years time?
Well, I think the single biggest point of success goes back to, we've gone into this village. Let's say it's 150 adults and their children. Their socioeconomic well-being, whatever, however they define it, not we define it, the measures that matter to them are now in place, and they have become a truly sustainable culture again. And I know that sustainable is kind of a buzzword, but you know what we've seen happen is, if you heal the environment, the farming gets better if it's a farming community, or the fisheries get better if it's a mangrove system. So their historic way of earning a living now works again. But then the women especially are frugal, and so they've sent their children to school, and we now have literally, I've lost track. We just have massive numbers of responsible parents who now have their children in school, because you know in the UK and in the US, education is provided through high school. That's not the case in many, many nations. So they have to afford an education for their children. And we have kids that are in university systems now.
Wow.
That started early and they've gone through the whole process. We have hundreds and thousands of kids, depending on the nation, that are now in school. And the women especially are good at saving money and starting micro enterprises. So they kind of further spin that economic cycle, and they're able to care for their own future and their retirement and do some really good things for their family. And I always think it's cute. If you go to Madagascar, I'll stick with Madagascar, and you interview them, say, well, you have some extra money. What did you buy? They'd say, it's almost everyone would say, we bought a bed with a mattress. I didn't know you could buy a bed without a mattress, but apparently you can. So I guess you just lay down in the middle of a wooden box. But the transformation socioeconomic means they now have come to communally own that forest. That's their forest, and nobody's going to cut down their forest again, because our fisheries are better, our farming is better, our lives are better. We're in harmony once again, like we were, two or three generations ago. We're now back in harmony. That's what I would consider success.
So would I.
Yeah. And we're seeing it.
We sure are. We sure are. And we are seeing it. But what I would also like to ask, and there are probably a million different answers we can give to this, and that is, how do we as a society move to a place where companies like ourselves, Eden Projects, are not having to retrospectively act because trees are being cut down left, right, and center, so we're planting new ones? How do we move away from a society that's actually chopping down trees and one that is more sustainable, and where actually reforestation projects don't need to exist anymore because we are working in such a holistic view with the environment? Now, this is a long, long term view. I'm just interested if you have any thoughts or perspectives on that.
Well, I don't know if you've heard much about the 1 trillion tree project.
No.
If you're concerned about climate change, and most people are, then to absorb the excess greenhouse gases in the atmosphere right now, the groups like Crowther Institute in Switzerland have come up with a model that says, in essence, if we plant a trillion trees, that will absorb sufficient atmospheric carbon to bring the temperature back to where it's at an acceptable level as we move away from carbon-based fuel and carbon-based energy.
Is that 1 trillion new trees that aren't in the ground right now?
Keep the ones we got plus 1 trillion more.
Wow.
I guess what I'm saying is we're a long ways away from not needing any forest restoration projects. And right now, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, if you count everything, every nonprofit, Eden has been identified as the largest tree plant, the most prolific tree planting nonprofit on the planet right now. And we'll do about 150 million trees this year. You say, wow, 150 million. And I'm going, oh, crap, only 150 million. Because we need a trillion. It's going to take us, at this rate, it'll take us about 3,000 years to get to the 1 trillion.
Okay.
So I think the key is, when I look at your house, you can't see the wood in my walls, but you see I'm sitting at a wooden chair and you have wooden beams. Every culture needs, some lumber. It's not a problem to harvest lumber. It's a problem to harvest it in an unsustainable way. And it's a problem not to connect poverty and deforestation. So bring them together. Fix at least two problems with one simple solution, but then you begin to add, okay, you get kids in school, you get water problems solved, you get loss of habitat for endangered species when you bring these two together. Mm-hmm. So let's reforest the heck out of the next couple of decades. And groups like yours, if everyone would be like you, doing what you can, not wiping yourself out economically to help somebody else, but doing what you can that's reasonable and relatively achievable. And we can fix the planet.
Absolutely.
There is enough money if everybody will chip in, and there is enough will if everybody will chip in. By the way, we need about 1,000 Eden groups.
Okay.
So start one, would you?
See what I can do. No, that it really does put it into perspective. Whenever when you mention the number 1 trillion, it's impossible to even comprehend what that number looks like. All we know is that it's a hell of a lot, right? And we all need to do, but at the same time, if we all focus on doing our own individual bit, then we move in that direction. So that's, you know, that's the place that we start. If we all take our own individual responsibility, then that 1 trillion number doesn't seem so huge after all.
Yeah, I mean, you do the math. I don't remember all the details, but I mean, there's 7 billion people on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just go with a couple of billion. If everybody would kick in $5, $10 or pounds or euros a month, it's done in probably 20 years.
Yep.
Because we can plant trees at 10 U.S. cents a tree. So it really is a pretty simple equation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's coming from a guy who couldn't get through organic.
What does the next 10 years look like for Eden Projects?
Scaling. Every day, these days I'm on the phone with, or not phone, Zoom. I'm old, so I think so. with our key leaders across the planet, looking at how do we scale, because we're planting, like this month we'll probably plant like 18 million trees this month.
Wow.
Which is a lot of trees sounding. It needs to become 180 million trees a month. And then, right?
Yep.
And then 1.8 billion trees a month, and so on and so forth. And it's all about developing multiplication systems where you get simple, reliable leadership systems that can be reproduced over and over again. Because planting trees is, and getting trees to grow is not hard. That freaks people out, but I always arrogantly say this. Trees have been grown by themselves for a long time.
Yep.
The issue is, can you fix the problem that's at the denominator? Everybody wants to look at the numerator. Look at the bottom of the equation. And that requires human systems. So that's what we're working on. I may have been too ambiguous with that answer, but
not at all. And it keeps coming back to the same place, which is humanity. You know, we have to put the power in our own hands, and we have to empower others to do the same too. You know, we built systems for so long at the expense of our environment, and now our responsibility is to build systems that work in harmony with our environment. And if we do that, we've proven to ourselves we're remarkably good at building systems. We're remarkably good at engineering growth and progress very, very quickly. We just need to change our measurements of what growth and progress look like.
Agreed. And we need to learn to hear each other. Side note, segue that I talked about before. I have a Scottish brother-in-law. I don't understand about 90% of what that guy said. So you need to send me an interpreter. Scottish English is a quandary, but again, it goes back to culture. It goes back to how do you work well as a global community? How can somebody in the UK connect with somebody in the US, connect with somebody in Haiti or Indonesia or Central America, and really make it work? We all do our part and listen well and care well and give not just money, but of our thoughts and our ingenuity.
Yeah. Feel you for sure. Amazing. Steve, is there anything else you would like to add about Eden Projects and the work that you're doing? Anything we haven't covered?
Um, I guess, you know, the thing that's amazed me about this is I didn't set off in my career to become this guy, become the founder and CEO of Eden Projects. So I've been as amazed by the results as anyone. And I would say this, kind of wrapping up, what I am excited about is we really do have a solution. It's now, we're now, you know, in our 15th, 16th year, depending on how you look at when we started. And it's working. It's working across cultural lines. So my hope is the word will spread, and the methodology will spread. There's got to be other groups out there that have tried and had marginal success, or even like the EU group that failed. Let's learn together. Let's take this employ to plant model and multiply it. That's my hope. That's my hope. Yeah, that's my hope.
Mine too. Mine too. And we've shown it can be done now. So now is the case of replicating. You know, the thing that gives me so much hope as well is when a system is successful, there are no shortage of people that can jump on that same bandwagon and amplify it. There are no shortage of change makers on this planet. So it now is just amplifying this message and getting out to the right people, and then watching it spread. And from small acorns grow big trees, right?
From acorns grow big trees that produce a lot of acorns. That produce a lot of trees that produce more acorns. So,
exactly.
Yeah. Let's do that.
The story writes itself. Yeah. Fantastic. Well, Steve, I hope we're in 10 years time we're back on this podcast and that 1 trillion number has gone way, 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 way down, right? And I believe it. Yeah, I believe we're heading in that direction. So on behalf of the entire Viva Life community, our staff, our customers, thank you for the change that you're making. It's such a pleasure to be a part of. We're just coming up to 200,000 trees ourselves now, so we're so proud of that number. We're gonna 10x that in the next year or so. Let's keep going and keep making a difference.
Great, Josh. Thank you so much for inviting me, and I look forward to chatting and planting a couple of billion trees together.
Sounds great, Steve. Right. Take care. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.